Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What do you prefer, Max, Cedric?
Tell me whatever you want, you know.
Max
is nice. Goes for you. Cornbread, it doesn't make any difference to me.
The big girls love that. Chicks love the last shot opportunity. Somebody give me a napkin so I can wipe my mouth.
I know you've been asked this question a million times, but how did you get that nickname?
Came from a movie called Cornbread Earl and Me. Jamal Wilkes used to play basketball for the Lakers. He was in a movie with Larry Fishburne way back in the 70s. And he was a basketball player. And I had the same kind of build Jamal had, and light color eyes, and people saw the movie, my buddies saw it, and they're like, you look like Cornbread. And I was like, what are you talking about? And the dude in the movie, I was like, what are you talking about? And I went to see the movie and saw Larry Fishburne was in the movie. It was about a basketball player who had befriended two little kids. And he ended up getting, and of all things, the irony of all this is that Jamal Wilkes, who played the his role, his name was Cornbread. He got killed by the police.
Damn.
And how appropriate is that? He was out running. There was a robbery at a store, and he was running home with a basketball. And the police say, "Stop running, you!" And he's like, he didn't even know they were talking to him. He got shot, the ball rolls away, and then Larry Fishburne, who was Cornbread Earl, and Larry Fishburne was me, he ended up telling the rest of the story. And they got on the witness stand, and he said, Cornbread wasn't doing anything. So all that to say, my buddies, who I went to school with at UNC Charlotte, used to call me the franchise. Well, we go to the NIT in 1976, and they're joking around in front of some of the reporters because they're asking me questions. And then one of my teammates said, yeah, you guys are talking to Cornbread. And man, the reporter's ears just shot up in the air. And a good Southern boy, Cornbread. And that's how it started. 1976 the NIT, where we got to the finals that year.
Crazy how one little moment can take it for years.
One little moment, one moment right now can take you away. So it doesn't make any difference. Right. One moment that we had, me in high school of getting cut from my high school team when I was a junior, and not making
it. That's a good nickname.
That was like you said, one moment. Paul Jones, who was coaching at the time.
I wanted to ask you about Paul Jones. Yeah.
Yeah, he was my coach, and I went out for the team as a junior. Well, I got hurt my sophomore year, so he didn't know me. I twisted my ankle, so I couldn't come back out for the junior varsity team.
And he cut you 11th grade?
Yeah, yeah.
When
I was in the 11th grade and went out for the team and got cut. And my buddies, you shouldn't have went out for the team. I told you we were going to get cut. And they had a good team. Paul Jones had a really good team and some really good players on the team.
Was Reggie Jones on that team?
Reggie Jones was on that team. Hot shot.
Alias, my dad told me to ask you that.
Alias hot shot. Yeah, I get all those stories about hot shot. Guy came up to me this year in Chicago. He said, I dated Esther Jones, who was Reggie Jones's older sister. And she tells me that you weren't even the best player on your high school team.
That's
that's pretty true. Reggie Hotshot was the man. I said, I was just engaging. I was averaging probably about 14, maybe 16 rebounds, 6 block shots, and about 12 points. So I was the engine though. Yeah, I wasn't the man, but Reggie Jones was driving the car.
And you played in the when did Granger turn into Kinston High? Did Granger and Atkins merge into Kinston High?
Yeah, this is 1970 the two schools integrated together. And I was around during that time, and we said
that gym,
from the team, and
so that gym that's there now. That's what
they're asking me. Paul Jones asked me, matter of fact, he said, "Are you going to come back out for the team?" Because he saw me in his PE class. So I was playing basketball and I was growing, and I said, "No, I'm not coming back out for the team." He's like, "Why?" I said, "You just cut me last year. Why would I come back out for the team?" He said, "Hey, if I'm you, I wouldn't worry about that right now." And so I came back out for the team, made the team, and the rest was Kinston history.
For real. I mean, you started this whole thing, right? You did. I mean, as far as the 1-52 or whatever the stat, you know, the whole players coming from Kinston to the NBA thing. You were the first one.
Like, yeah.
To have a career and to not only have a long career, but also you won finals MVP. You had the biggest trophy case.
That's true. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to question that at all.
How does it feel to be the guy that jump-started this whole thing?
Well, I talked to Paul Jones's son. He came up to Boston. Early before the season. Well, during last season. I think it was like October. Him and his wife were up, and they came by my apartment. And we sat down and we talked. And he said, "You know, let me say this to you. People ask me all the time, who's the best player from Kinston?" And he said, "The most talented player was Jerry Stackhouse." He said, "But the best player was you." He said, "Look at your body of work. So if my body of work speaks for me, then so be it."
I interviewed him for the documentary. He was great. Mm-hmm. And it was a key thing. You can't get Paul Jones, so you got to get the kid at least. I mean, he gave us a little history lesson,
mm-hmm.
if you will. So it's cool that you actually, because Paul Jones coached from 57 to 95 or something like that.
It was something like that. Paul was around a long time, that was a big controversy, because when we got there, we had a coach at the school, which was the black school at the time, Akin, and his name was Mr. Fleming, Harold Fleming. And everybody was like, he has to be the coach because Akin has such a dynamic team. And Paul Jones had won, I think he had won a state championship or something like that. So at the end of the day, they made Coach Fleming made him the assistant under Paul Jones.
Okay. I didn't know that. The thing about Akin, man, I didn't get too deep into the history of it, but if this was a longer documentary, I wanted to explore Akin history and merge that with Granger and then kind of lead those two threads into the Kinston High integration.
Well, it would be a great one to do, because you go to the archives, and the archives person would be my mother. My mother happened to play at Akin during her time when she was coming up.
Awesome.
And she was the person who, at the end of the day, when Paul Jones cut me, she's like, called him on the phone and said, "Coach, why'd you cut him? He's a good player."
What'd he say?
He's like, "Well, Miss Maxwell, we he's okay, but you know, we have a bunch of really good players. And we couldn't keep everybody." Right? So
There's no limit to the – it's crazy. They're talking about cutting 60 to 70 kids every year still in 2020. Like, it's crazy.
Just reading your snippets on it, it's for whatever reason, it's an amazing place to play basketball. And the mecca of all of it for especially in that community was Holloway Center. It was a common thread that everybody went to that place and we all played. And at Holloway, the gym wasn't as big, so we essentially played half court basketball. And fundamentally, I think that made you that much better, because when you play full court in a pickup game, you might get one or two good runs where everybody is occupied. Everybody is, you know, running up and down the floor. Well, when you play half court and it was 3-on-3, your fundamentals got to be better, because everybody had to handle the ball. Everybody had to be able to shoot. Everybody had to defend. And, you know, you weren't going to be snowbirding trying to get a layup at one end of the floor. So you were consistently playing defense and you were consistently playing offense. And I think that was one of the things that was really good about playing at Holloway Center. There was a little boys in that you had to graduate and then eventually go to the big boys in and play down there. And, you know, it was like, playing down there was like going to Madison Square Garden. Everybody was down there watching. You get down there, you make one mistake, and they're going, you weren't going to play. Yep, you were getting cut, and you weren't going to play anymore. And if you lost, even if you were good and you lost, you were 3, 4, 5 games deep before you got a chance to play again.
That's beautiful. That right there explains a lot.
Yep, that is that. That's why people say it was David Linhart was the – he was the director of Holloway Center, and you know, gosh, he was brutal. And then it was Mr. Cofield, Jeffrey Cofield. He was the other man after him, and I remember really a Holloway. The thing about it was David Linhart was he was a taskmaster, and he had no pay. You're funny, you think about patience. He had no patience for kids at all. He came in, and because I probably could have been a pretty good football player. I went out for the football team, and I was a quarterback because I was tall. And all he'd say was, you know, hike, and all I'd do is throw the ball. Hike, throw. He kept saying, drop back. I wasn't dropping back. I say hike, and I just throw it. And he's like, finally said, drop back, you knucklehead. And I went home, and I swore that day I never played football again. It was funny.
When you're drafting your fantasy team, do you ever wish you could do the same thing with your business team? If you're building a roster to win the league, you need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Don't spend hours on multiple job sites looking for candidates with the right skills when you could do it all with Indeed. Find top talent fast with Indeed's suite of powerful hiring tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. Hate waiting? Indeed's U.S. data shows that over 80% of Indeed employers find quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match their job description the moment they sponsor a job. One of the things that separates Indeed from the rest is their Instant Match feature. Candidates you invite to apply through Instant Match are 3 times more likely to apply to your job than candidates who only see it in search, according to U.S. Indeed data. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. Indeed does the hard work for you. Sponsor a job, and then boom, Instant Match shows you candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your job description immediately after you post. With Instant Match, you can start hiring fast. Join over 3 million businesses worldwide using Indeed to hire great talent fast. Indeed knows that you're doing everything for your company. You can't afford to overspend on hiring. Visit Indeed.com/Maxwell to start hiring now. Just go to Indeed.com/Maxwell. Indeed.com/Maxwell. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application. Pricing not available for everyone. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Let me ask you, I don't know where I read this or heard this, but I hear you still play spades at Holloway sometimes.
Oh, God. That might be the spade capital of the world. That might be the card capital, the junk talking from playing spades. But everything was so competitive at Holloway. You know, it didn't have the best equipment, but there was ping pong. You had great ping pong players there. You had people Holloway Center had a swimming pool. And I always say people of color didn't know how to swim. Well, people of color used to swim at the pool all the time. So it was, everything was so competitive. There was baseball, football, but basketball at the end of the day kind of trumped all of it, if you have to say about spades. But yeah, spade tournaments and bid whist, it was even now, even today, when I go back to Kinston now, I don't play basketball, but I go to Holloway just to play spades and talk noise.
That's great. I mean, it's like Holloway is the epicenter, I guess, of that competitive fire in Kinston. But even Kinston in general, I mean, I'm not from that side of town. I didn't play at Holloway, but I got some competition in me, you know, in a different way. I want to be the best that I can be with filmmaking and with, you know, just be whatever I'm doing. I just want to be the best I can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what drives me. And I got to give that credit to Kinston and the people that I grew up around, I feel like. I feel like this town in general is something's good. I ain't gonna say something in the water no more, but
you can.
There's something there that it really truly is. There's something special about it. Like the people.
Well, I think the biggest thing about Kinston to me is that people are constantly looking for ways out of Kinston. And I think because of that, you have an opportunity, if it's basketball, if it's filmmaking, football, whatever it might be, you don't see Kinston as the end of the road. I mean, one time Kinston was like this, well, Eastern North Carolina was Kinston was the Mecca. Everything else was like East Carolina, nah, Goldsboro, no. But Kinston, you know, because of the airport, because of the mall, because of all those things that Kinston had at the time, which are now gone. You know, Kinston, even now, when Donald Trump has to fly into North Carolina or Eastern North Carolina, where does he have to land? The longest runway past Raleigh is in Kinston. So he has to land there in Kinston with Air Force One. So Kinston has all these things which are there out of the past, which have gone. If you remember Kinston, you remember the mall. The mall was like, man, you go to the, what are we going to do today? If you want to have fun, we're going to go to the mall.
Take
now the mall is gone. There is no mall. It's hard for a mall to die. And you know, in that way, you can see Kinston, that part of it is dying.
Remember that Sound Shop?
What?
Sound Shop, Take 10.
Oh, yeah, everything in Kinston, you know, having the, you know, Chick-fil-A was in there. They had the arcade in there. All the stores and, you know, to see those things gone now. And it's really strange because we live, my mother and father and my sister and brother, we lived in the east part of Kinston. And just to see how it has just kind of deteriorated to the point that my father, who was in the military, and my mom, she wanted to move to the west side of Kinston, you know, to some of the really good homes over there. And my father always said he's 94 years old now. And he always told us that my next home is going to be with St. Peter. But, you know, about 10 years ago, he moved. My mom had him move, and they live on the west side of Kinston. And if you look at the neighborhoods there compared to the rest of Kinston, like, you know, totally another city.
I don't mean to sound dumb, but what would be the west side of Kinston? What neighborhoods?
Let me see. If you, those schools,
Gilchrist?
the homes that are up there, you know where Fairfield is. Fairfield. Those homes in there up near the golf course.
Country Club. Oh, yeah.
Country Club and all that. Those are some nice homes.
Oh, yeah. So I grew up near Bethel Church over there and that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that would be. It doesn't matter. But then, look, they took me out to the country in my ninth grade year. So I had to go live in Hugo near Grifton.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, oh, my God, it's terrible. Ooh. Talk about boredom. But, again, it goes back to what you said, like talking about people wanting to get out, that being a motivator. That is so true. That's it right there.
Yeah.
And when I went to Grifton or Hugo, I had to go. I had to get out.
That's where what's his name? His son's in the NBA.
Mitchell Wiggins? Andrew Wiggins?
Mitchell. Mitchell Wiggins. Mitchell Wiggins was from the area. And I just found the other day, well, the last couple of years, I found out about Starlight, the Starlight Barbecue.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And like that is that's some great stuff. So there's a lot of stuff about Kinston. And I thought one day I said, maybe I could move back there because you get so much for your money. But, you know, but now with the internet, it probably wouldn't be a bad place to stay for the price that you get for your house.
Yeah.
And all those things that went along with it. And if you get older, you know, you're not going as many places. I think Kinston wouldn't be a bad place to stay.
Can we talk about Kinston, the town? Just like you did a little bit as far as what it used to be versus what it is now. Mm-hmm. But like what it is now, like going back to the mall, you know, there's a shot in the documentary where like it shows the movie theater in the behind the mall. I saw all my movies there growing up. And now I go back there and it is a haunted house. You know what I mean?
It's
some people were acting like Kinston didn't seem to be in as much trouble as I was seeing.
Yeah.
A few people.
I agree with you. I mean,
because I was confused by that.
Well, look at this. You can just go down Queen Street. You just go Queen Street. When I was coming up as a little boy, was like the place to be. And me and my brother laughed about it because they used to have a commercial that Kinston Chamber of Commerce would put on called the Magic Mile. And from the top of Queen Street all the way to the end was just, you know, stores and buildings and shops, and you could eat and all that. And now essentially you go there and you find out that all that stuff has disappeared. And I used to go to a movie theater, which was right. They had two movie theaters, matter of fact, on Queen Street. One was a black theater called the State Theater. And then the other one was the Paramount. And then they had one that called the Park.
Okay. Yeah.
And the Park was going up near, if you went north, up near North.
Emma Webb.
Huh?
Kind of near Emma Webb, right?
Yeah, right near Emma Webb. That's where the Park. That's,
I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's where. Yeah, you are from Kinston, because you asked about stuff. You're going, you, where are you from? Guy said,
I don't know if this is going to be entertaining to anybody else. But
yeah, somebody asked me that time. This guy actually, this woman said she's from Kinston. I was like, where are you? She said, oh, well, actually, I'm from Hookerton. I said, well, you ain't from Kinston. You ain't from Kinston. You're from Hookerton or Snow Hill or, you know.
Green County.
You're from Savannah. So I went to Savannah High School. No, you're not from Kinston.
That's funny. Well, credit to Stephen Hill. He's brought some stuff back, one of the Hill kids, to Heritage Street, I guess, you know.
Mm.
But Queen Street apparently is what they're trying to do next. So hopefully they can work something out.
Well, I think there's still, you know, there's still some old money there. You know, I look at the, what's it, the restaurant that they have that's become famous now.
Back in the Farmer, yeah.
Yeah, and that was surprising to me. Then to have a brewery and just have a little Art Deco area, which to me was a surprise. But Kinston has it has a lot of potential to be, but there's going to have to be some manufacturing there. One thing people talk, my father used to talk all the time, oh, this place is going to boom when the trans park gets here.
Oh, yeah.
Trans park. Oh,
that's what I grew up on. Global trans park.
We're going to build this stuff. We're going to build that. And the trans park is going, and the trans park never, ever came true.
No, they dug the runway.
Because of that, there was that. One of the best jobs you could get at one time in Kinston was DuPont. You go to DuPont, and boy, if you can get on at DuPont, that was it. Can you get on at DuPont? And you were going to, you know, your life was going to be made. And now I think they said there's a skeleton crew. It used to be like 2,500 people.
All robots now, probably.
Yeah, now they say it's like, you know, maybe 200 people that work there now. Damn. So the manufacturing, you think about, that's the thing that makes, you know, cities, you know, viable, or if they have a great school. Kinston had a chance really to get East Carolina University. But Kinston turned it down.
Why did they do that?
Yeah, Kinston just...
We all heard about that. And we all say, why? What's going on? And it's like, that seems to be the pattern in Kinston. I love Kinston, but it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Oh, why don't you just take what's good for you? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it. If you had East Carolina, if you had the airport was back, you know, you're already, and you look how East Carolina is, you look at Greenville, how it's exploding. It's a, you know, it's like a completely different world. Or you go to New Bern, or you go to Wilson. Yeah. All these places are still growing, and Kinston has taken this back seat. It's still the same sleepy town that we knew when we were coming up, but even more sleepier now.
This episode of the Cedric Maxwell Podcast brought to you by BetOnline.ag. Football is back, and BetOnline is your number one source for all your football betting needs and sports info this season. Find all of the latest football odds, news, and game matchups, including this year's opening week's games. BetOnline is your continued source for all your wagering information, including live betting, free concerts, and live scores. Always the fastest and easiest to bet on all your favorite sports and events, including MLB, MMA, tennis, boxing, and even golf. Head to betonline.ag to join and receive your 100% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Make sure you use the promo code CLNS50 to receive your rewards. It's BetOnline, where the game starts.
And look at it on the map, too. It's a perfect position for, like, for a lot of things, I would imagine, you know, and it's surrounded by success. And I don't want to knock down Kinston. I love Kinston. But, it's again, it's just frustrating because it's almost like – the ball has been dropped a little bit, you know?
No, I don't think that. I think in your documentary, the ball has been dropped. You make decisions in life. You can make. You and I just talked about making small decisions in life. Small decisions are going to have sometimes huge consequences. And you think about how Kinston has been over the years. And if you had taken, you know, East Carolina University, if you'd have, you know, built your airport up that much more, you know, all the infrastructure that we talk about, Kinston is like bypass now. They got the bypass and that's it. You only have to come into Kinston anymore.
No,
so,
yeah.
Kinston is, yeah. But you know, but the most amazing thing about Kinston though, is that literally, if you say you're from Kinston, North Carolina, somebody's gonna know where it's at. No, everybody's gonna know where it's at. People who were, you know, from, who lived in Jacksonville, who were at Camp Lejeune. Oh, Kinston. Oh, we used to go there all the time. You know, Goldsboro. So it's all these amazing stories which kind of come along with Kinston. And to top that off was, and I'm sure you probably got it in your research, but Kinston essentially, like in 1960, I won't get the dates right, but like about 1961, the only nuclear bomb was dropped outside of Kinston. I want to say that was in LaGrange.
Yeah.
And they said that the plutonium in the bomb was so deep in the ground, that it was still in the groundwater. So I always laugh and say, that's how maybe how we got all these mutant kids that we had in Kinston to be who they were, you know, with plutonium, because, you know, that's the thing you always hear about Kinston. You have on the license plate of the city all the time, Kinston, home of pure artesian well water. That was one of the things that used to be on the sign of, you know, like if you were from Kinston.
You know what? Somebody brought that up and we were filming. That's crazy, though. Like, what was that? That was in the Baxter Holmes article, right? The Dexter Holmes.
He researched that, and that's what happened.
That's wild, though.
It was over in Goldsboro at that time. It was the Cold War, and they were flying these big B-52 bombers. And one night, one of the wings came off, and the plane ended up crashing. But out of the belly of the plane came two nuclear bombs. One, the parachute worked. Number two bomb went supersonic. And so it headed towards the ground and hit the ground, but did not detonate. And supposedly that bomb was 10 times the power of Hiroshima. They said it would have been the Bay of Kinston, and people maybe now, maybe today, would be going back to live in the area, but it would have devastated completely the whole area.
Thank you, Jesus.
Yes, indeed. There we go again, those small things, because a guy said the trigger device was on, but the bomb didn't explode.
That's crazy. Crazy. Before I forget, the industries of it all and them needing to come back and what used to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Hampton Industries?
Yeah. My mom worked at the shirt factory. They didn't call it Hampton.
Oh, really?
They didn't call it Hampton. They just called it the shirt factory.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
You know that the shirt factory was right over in that part of Kingston, over near Carver Court Lovett Hines and all those different. That's where the shirt factory was.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because my fellow producer Dustin Taylor, his family was. I think his stepfather is Chusid, last name Chusid. So they had a heavy hand in that. And that's gone. My first job ever was cropping tobacco.
Oh, good Lord, man.
Over there in Arba.
You're going to take me. Look, I crop tobacco all over the Kingston area. Out in Woodington, out in near Savannah. Yeah. That, you know what would get you out of Kingston? That'll get you out of Kingston.
I was 14. I was like, what?
Yeah.
$70?
Dropping tobacco. You know, we got our guy Nick who is listening to this. He wouldn't know, understand. He's a big cigarette smoker. That's why I don't smoke cigarettes today. Working in tobacco was something you get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, you on somebody's truck, and you're going out in the cold. It was hot, but it was wet. So you would have to wear rain gear for probably like the first 2 hours because you would be soaking wet. And then you're pulling off layers. By the time you got the lunch, you were down to your t-shirt. And you're talking about you'd have these worms on you and
tobacco juice everywhere.
Your hands were literally black with tar. Your fingertip, you could tell if somebody worked in tobacco during the summer because you look at the cuticles of their fingers and they will always have this green ring in there, which was essentially the pesticides that they put in the tobacco to kill the worms and the bugs so it wouldn't eat the tobacco. But it surely got in your system. If you think about it, if it goes into your cuticles, that means it's in your system. Not in your hand. It's in your system. So
look, after 3 days, I said, I'll see y'all later. That's what I said.
Wow. I made kind of a career of it. I got to probably like year 4 or 5.
But you really did it.
Because that was one of those things you were able to do in Kingston and make extra money.
Right.
Remember, we didn't have a McDonald's. McDonald's didn't exist. What we had was Hardee's. Hardee's was the first restaurant that, you know, you went to, and now it's gone. Hardee's is gone international, but that was the first place you went. But there was no summertime jobs that you could get in Kingston other than working in the fields. That was essentially it.
You know what's crazy?
Or cutting somebody's grass.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the grass always growing over there. My parents met at Hardee's.
Did they? Wow.
My dad told me that last week. He said, I met your mom. I saw your mom at Hardee's on Heritage Street.
There was only one Hardee's. And that was
right. Hardee's on now.
There was only one Hardee's over there on Vernon. Because about the streets which were famous. You had Queen Street and you had Vernon. They connected almost in the L shape. And you go to the mall and come back and now you look that whole area, like that Hardee's is now gone. All those buildings over there essentially are done.
This episode of Cedric Maxwell Podcast is brought to you by Masterclass. Right now, when you head to masterclass.com/CLNS, you'll get an annual membership and they'll give you one for free just for listening to this podcast. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity.
No, you don't really. I mean, Masterclass, you are learning so many things and exactly what they're saying. Masterclass, master teachers, could be somebody, if you have a poor golf swing, could be somebody teaching you who is a great golfer, teaching you about golf.
Absolutely. There's endless opportunities. And one of the classes that they offer is TV writing. And it's taught by Shonda Rhimes, the mastermind behind one of the greatest TV shows put together, Grey's Anatomy.
bunch of other movies. Her credentials are endless. And right now, if you head over to masterclass.com/CLNS, you can get a free membership, an annual membership, and sign up for her class or a dozen others.
Yeah, dozens, all kinds of things that you want to do in your life. You want to be a great cook? You might have a chef that would be up there who would be teaching you how to cook maybe your Thanksgiving meal, which is coming up.
There you go.
That you get in this master class and they show you how to brine a turkey or do whatever people do with
whatever
a turkey.
Whatever side you like, they got
you.
Yeah,
right? So they, as you like to say, they got you. Exactly. They got you.
Explore at your own pace with over 90 classes that range from world-class instructors. Right now, head over to masterclass.com/CLNS. That's masterclass.com/CLNS.
So what do you think's next for Kinston? What can we do? I don't know. I mean, what can anyone do for Kinston? They need manufacturing.
Need manufacturing.
Do you think NAFTA needs manufacturing?
And I think that would help with some of the people who are there who are so stagnant. Right. And you said, to get out of Kinston, to get away from some of the people who, and love the people, but seeing some of the same people who are my age are still standing on the corner. I mean, that's not a good look. That's not an investment in your future. If you're going to be standing on the block and hanging out,
there's no opportunities there. And it's like, what are you supposed to do? Besides, the only choice you have is to move. Yeah. You know, for a lot of folks, like.
That was it.
So I mean, it's just a frustrating place. But
that's essentially it. It's such a wonderful town. I absolutely love my hometown. Again, it's one of those towns that that if there isn't something major that happens eventually, it's going to just fade more and more and more. But I think that's why their basketball program and their athletics were so good, is because again, people found that was their opportunity to get out. I know that was mine. I used to think about like, okay, what am I going to do in Kinston? You know, what am I going to do and because I got cut from the team, I really didn't think about anything. I remember being in my sophomore year at Kinston High School, and that was the teachers were going down the line saying, okay, what do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? And so
Finals MVP,
and he went down the line, and again I wasn't paying attention, and the guy in front of me said he wanted to be a social worker, and I was next. So what would you like to be? I want to be what the guy in front of me is. Whatever he was, I want to be that. So I didn't think about anything, and then basketball was thrust upon me, or I was thrust upon it, and it gave me an opportunity to leave Kinston and see a much bigger world, and to get to Charlotte and see a really different side of North Carolina.
Final Four. You took Charlotte to the Final Four. That's a big deal. And my dad, I was asking my dad. My dad obviously is a big influence on me with basketball. What did he tell me to ask you? He said he played against you at Fairfield once. I'm like, all right.
Wow.
He said Final Four. Remember, what did he say? Y'all play Marquette.
Yeah, we were my school, UNC Charlotte, 1976, we made the NIT. And that's when it was a big deal. It was a big deal. And I was the MVP in the NIT on the losing team. We lost to Kentucky in the final minutes. And then the next year, my school, UNC Charlotte, goes into the Sun Belt Conference, started the Sun Belt, and we win the Sun Belt. We win our tournament, and we are now, there was only at that time, it was like people say the big dance. Well, there was only 32 people in that big dance. So you had the best of the best. And we beat Central Michigan, and we beat Syracuse University. And Syracuse was a big deal at the time. And their assistant coach over there was a young Rick Pitino, was their assistant coach. And then we played the number one team in the country because we were in the West, in the Midwest, and that was Michigan. And we ended up beating Michigan to go to the Final Four.
And what was your seeding?
Michigan was number one. They were number one in the country.
What was the UNC seed? What was it?
We were like the sixth seed or something. Nice. Fifth or sixth seed in the Midwest. Nobody knew who we were. I mean, nobody. They knew when we left because there was a guy. I remember this distinctly. We're playing Central Michigan first game, and you know, everybody gets these big write-ups. You know, coach is always pumping somebody up, and they had a super sophomore on their team, white guy, and I was playing in the game. I don't remember his name, but I had like 12 points early in the game. And so the super sub comes in and he's going to stop me. So I guess, you know, you do like this, you walk up to the toughest guy in the bar and you punch him. He walks up to me and he says, you know what? I don't give a damn what All-American team you on. And I, without missing a beat, I had my head at the free throw line. I lifted my head up. I looked at him in the eye. I said, after this fucking game, you will. So after I had 32 and 18, he comes up to me after the game and does, good luck in the pros, big fella. That was his line to me. So those were things you could see that you were, that we had progressed and we were that kind of team. I didn't know where UNC Charlotte was. It's just like, I thought it was, when I got my letter from, said UNC, I'm thinking like, damn, Chapel Hill done changed it, whatever it is.
Right.
And I ended up going there and I loved the school. And so we had a long fight to get from under the wing of the ACC.
Right.
You know, we did just that in those 4 years. So I was there. Matter of fact, the 4 years I was at UNC Charlotte, we never lost a home game. We won, I think we were 56 and 0.
Damn, that's
at home in my 4 years of college.
That's wild. So what was the transition like between NCAA and NBA?
Draft,
how did that all go?
It was cream of the crop. It was guys you had read about, guys you look at. And, you know, my first day, I'm looking at with Boston, I get drafted. And I didn't want Boston to draft me because I wanted to stay south. And Atlanta was, I found out there was two picks after that. So I wanted to go to Atlanta. That's where I really wanted to play. And Chicago was after that. So it was Milwaukee picked number 11, Celtics picked number 12. Chicago was 13 and Atlanta was number 14. So I was hoping that any one of those teams I went to, I didn't want to go to Milwaukee, but Chicago and Atlanta were my picks, and got picked by Boston and went to their rookie camp. And I'm looking at John Havlicek, Dave Collins, JoJo White. I mean, it was just like Charlie Scott. I'm looking at all these guys who were soon to be Hall of Famers, and was just my mouth was just open. And then the guys that you played against in the NBA that you start seeing, like Dr. J, or you saw my favorite player of all time was Kareem, playing against them. It's just, it was just eye-opening to be in that particular area and to see those guys and to say that, you know, hey, they put on, as that story said, they put on their jock just like I did, one leg at a time. That was eventually I saw them put their jock on. Like, damn, they do. They put their one leg in, and then literally, they put the other leg in. So they're literally just like me.
Let me ask you though. So, like, when you did finally get in that in the moment of on the court playing with these guys, playing against these guys, did they seem better than you imagined they would be, or did they seem like they weren't quite as, I mean, what was that? I mean, as far as their game, like, did it seem?
No, they seem. How much hype? No, they seem who they were. Dr. J seemed who he was. Kareem, you know, all these guys seemed like who they were. They were great players who were outstanding. That I was thinking, like, man, I am playing against the greats. And then, I think my first year, it was, you know, I was playing a few minutes. I averaged maybe about 7-8 points a game. And then I wasn't playing as much. And then all of a sudden, Kinston kicked in.
Oh, ooh.
my second year in the league and like, you know what? I'm from Kinston, damn it. I don't give a damn about these guys. I don't give a fuck about Kareem. I don't care who these guys are. I know that I'm just as good as these guys. And I went from averaging about 8 points to averaging 19 points and about 10 rebounds a game my second year. So at that time, I knew I could play with the big boys and I knew I could be dominant.
People are products of their environment, right?
I mean, yes, they are. Yes, they are. You go back to Holloway and you put yourself in those situations or go to Kinston High School and Mock Gym, the Madhouse. You think about those times of, you know, being in Mock Gym and playing against Phil Ford, was a great player up in Rocky Mount, coming to Kinston to play. Or my brother was, 5 years after me, and he told me how Michael Jordan came to Mock Gym and put on the show there. So there have been legends who have come in that particular building and that in the Eastern North Carolina, just the basketball alone in North Carolina. You think about some of the greats who have been Eastern North Carolina. You've got Buck Williams, got Dominique Wilkins.
Oh, yeah.
Phil Ford was from there. Myself, Stackhouse, Shackelford. There's so many people who played basketball in that area that competitively that you just, you know, you got better. You know, it's like you, when you played the better competition, the better you became.
Yeah.
You can think about when you played, and I always tell people, it's like when you become a player, it's like, first of all, you have to dominate your neighborhood. You got to be the best person on your block.
Right. Right.
Then now you got to be the best person in the city. You got to be one of the elites in the city. Uh-huh. Then you become the elite in the state. And now you go from there. There's only one thing you can do, be one of the best in the world. And for me to be a finals MVP and all that good stuff, I hark that back to Kinston. Matter of fact, the jersey that they gave me, I ended up putting it in the trophy case in the new Kinston High.
Uh-huh. It's crazy because you talk about Kinston kicked in when you went from 8 points to 19 points. And that's just such a full circle thing right there. Like we got something in filmmaking called Hero's Journey, storytelling, you know, the Hero's Journey, where it's just this circular kind of a balanced like thing. And yeah, you went all the way to the NBA, but what made you ultimately great in the NBA is Kinston kicked in, where you're from kicked in, and you kind of like returned
home. K-Town kicked in, brother.
And I want to say, because I feel bad about talking, I was talking too much junk about Kinston right now. I want people to know that, like, the thing about Kinston is so beautiful because of its pain and its struggles. You know what I mean? The basketball and, say, the lack of opportunity and the crime and all that stuff, that's what makes it so dramatic and so beautiful in the first place. Like, it's a lot of small towns don't have a lot going on. But at least Kinston has basketball.
The history goes back, you know, for when I was, and I have to go back when I was born in the 50s, when Kinston was segregated, when it was a typical Southern town, and you had a bus station, which had a white area and it had a colored area. There was water fountains in Kinston at the time. There were separate movie theaters. There was Holloway and there was Granger and there was, you know, like then you and all of a sudden it was like this. All right. I'm black and I'm going to Fairfield to play basketball. That was like a big thing, and, you know, as it kind of went on. So all these things made you who you were and made that city the city that it is. And hopefully one day we'll, you know, be like Phoenix. It'll rise from the ashes. Somebody will come in and put the industry in, and there are a lot of, you know, very hungry people in Kinston who want an opportunity.
Hungry. They're so hungry.
Yeah.
That's it. You feel like it's progress? You feel like it's progressed at all? Like since you growing up?
No. I don't think there's.
I mean, from like a racial standpoint?
Oh, from not. Well, when you have a black mayor. Yeah, you've changed a little bit. You've changed your characteristics as a city. So yeah, for you to have a black mayor, the police force, and all those other things, over kind of in the black neighborhood. So, yeah, I think Houston, some of that has changed for the better. But a lot of things just have not grown as we look back on the city as it's kind of falling apart. A lot of the homes and stuff that are there.
So if I were to continue this documentary, what would you suggest I focus on? Did you see? Did you get a chance to check out the short version?
I did. I saw your short version. I love the stat that the guy gave about, you know, if you wore the Kilston High School varsity jersey, then it was
52.7 players.
Some number he gives, and he said that number any place else is 15,000.
So after he said it, I looked over at the camera to make sure I was recording because I was like, "What?
Is this true?" But I mean that I think you go with that. I don't know where you go with Kinston.
Even the town itself, maybe. It could be anything. I mean, I would like to dive back into the history.
I have no idea how you go back because I just look at, again, just where I live in the eastern part of the city. And that is beyond Queen Street. Anything east of Queen Street has kind of just fallen into, like I said, the shirt factory was there. So you had industry around, you had, you know, eateries were around, you had all these different things around. I'm just more amazed right now that you still have Carver Court and those, you know, Carver Court and Mitchell Wooten, and you still have the projects in Kinston. I think that would be the next place I would look just to find out, you know, what these people, you know, because there is history there in the projects,
right,
that people don't even talk about. And why would you stay in the projects? I mean, if you were born in the projects, why would you stay in the projects? You see some people who were born in Carver Court, the projects, and still generations have, their next family has gone where they live, still in Carver Court, in the projects. I can't even imagine what those homes are like anymore. You think about it. I think I would go there if I wanted to get some real history about what Kinston's alike. You know, Mitchell Wooten, Carver Court, Lovett Hines, all those places. I think I'd take that next step. It was a gentleman who had a store over there. His name was J.D. Connors. He had a store over in Kinston on Shine Street, which was a grocery store. And he looked out for people over there. A white man, but he looked out for people. He would let my mom didn't have money. I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, it was a song that was on the radio just yesterday. I was listening to it. And it was one thing that we used to do in Kinston that a lot of other places didn't do, that you think about the words he used and said, was lay away. What you gonna do? I'm gonna put that on the lay away. You gonna get those shirts? I know it. That slaps you right in the face right there.
My mama going to Kmart.
You're gonna put a pair of sneakers that you pay $4 and then another $4, or then you got stuff on layaway, which is even today is like this famous word that was in Kinston that, you know. What you gonna do? Oh, I'm gonna put that on layaway.
But see, that's all normal to me growing up. And that was probably just a little subtle.
I understand that because there wasn't anything called credit back in the day.
Right.
That was your credit, but you weren't taking it home and you had to work for it. That's what tobacco fields were for. You know, you're gonna like, okay, you're gonna put that. Oh, I'm gonna put $5 on that and put it on layaway and I'll come back and get it. I'm sure there's some things right now that you still have on layaway that you never went back to get.
That's hilarious. Well, after you, first of all, NBA Finals MVP, mm-hmm. Where do you keep the trophy? Where is it right now?
Don't even have it anymore.
Really?
And I gave it to my mom, had it. Oh. Then I have my, the only thing I have right now, I think, is my watch. The Finals MVP watch. Everything else now is gone. Sold it. Got rid of it because those things I don't identify with.
Yeah, and if it's got value, and you know, Larry Bird. You've been asked all these questions before, but what was Larry like? What was Parrish?
Yeah, what was all Robert? What was Larry? Well, Larry was the first one that I actually met that came into the league. It was Larry came in I was going into my third year, and we drafted Larry junior eligible. One of the last times that happened. Larry was supposed to be a senior. You could draft kids who were supposed to be seniors. That's what Red Auerbach did. He drafted Larry junior eligible. So when Larry came to us, it was like they had to sign Larry or he was going back into the draft, and had such a great year. I think Boston took Larry Bird with the sixth pick in the draft. And in 1978 or 79, one of them. But that was my sophomore year and my second year. So my third year, Larry walks into the building, and I'm thinking in my mind, I'm like, great white hope. Here he comes. Okay. This ought to be a piece of work, right? This ought to be easy. So me and Larry played against each other the first couple of days. And, man, I gave him every possible move that I could give him. And, no, he didn't stop me. I'd have been averaging 30 points a game, you know, because Larry was not a defender. But what I found out later, because I was so prejudiced about basketball, because we've been taught over the years that, you know, as black players, white boys can't play. What are you talking about? They can't play. And first day of practice, hands down from about 15 feet away, he knocks down the first jump shot. Kind of turn my head. Yeah, knocks down the second one, third one. It's like, damn. Now I'm just sweating now. By the end of the day, practice ends. I get to the first black guy I could see, first black person. I'm like, you know what? That fucking white guy can play. And that was my introduction to Larry Bird, and that now that I could identify with a white guy that was actually probably that he it hurts me to say it now, that was actually better than I was. And I just couldn't identify with that at all. You know, when I was in college or basically coming to the pros, I didn't think that way.
And he was from he's from Indiana.
Right? Yeah. And then I was saying, God was a funny God. Not only did he give me Larry Bird, but he gave me two of the greatest white players to play at one time on the same team. It's Kevin McHale.
Right. So
you drop that in and sprinkle a little bit of Danny Ainge in there. Now all of a sudden you're going, damn, these white guys can really play. We done cornered the market right now on white players.
There ain't nothing left.
Yeah.
Burr was a product of his environment, right? That Indiana basketball.
Yeah, he was a product. It was really strange in 1977. I played against which was going to eventually be one of my teammates. 1976, actually. Played against Robert Parrish, who went to Centenary University. And we played them in Charlotte. And we were both top independents at the time in the country. And whoever was going to be the best independent was going to shoot them forward. Well, we played them in Charlotte in front of about 12,000 people. And we ended up winning the game. And I heard a story about 2 months ago about a guy who was actually sitting in the front row, told me about this game. He said, man, I was there. I was watching the game. It was James Worthy. So, you know, you just think about how you influence people in this way. And you see them and you just kind of laugh and how things happen. So those were the great players that I played with. You know, Dennis Johnson, Nate Archibald. But, you know, people talk about the Hall of Fame. And I said, the Hall of Fame, when the Boston Celtics retired my jersey and put it up in the rafters, I said at that time, I said, the Hall of Fame is in Springfield, Massachusetts. No offense at all to them. But the Hall of Fame is right up in these, right above my head where I'm going now. And you think about the Celtics, everybody said, oh, you know, if you can win two in a row or three-peat or what, damn, Celtics won eight championships in a row. Not just eight championships. Bill Russell has 11 championship rings. I mean, Sam Jones has 10. And then Michael Jordan or whoever does, they go 5 or 6 or what. This man has 11. You know, he needs one of your fingers to occupy all his rings.
Right. Well, I got to ask you before I forget, coming from Kinston, small town, and then playing in front of a big crowd, what is that like? You get used to it by just doing it, I'm sure. But
yeah, it was like playing the Holloway. So like playing the Holloway with the
once
big
you start boys. Playing, you're playing.
The pressure that you had when you stepped down, when you came from the little boys end to the big boys end and playing your first 3-on-3 in front of, you know, they had bleachers on both sides were packed with people. And it was critics. Oh, my God. Critics upon critics. There'd be a few women sprinkled in. It's like it was like going to play at Madison Square Garden. It was like playing in the Mecca, you know. So that alone to me just took the nerves out of it. You know, to me, a basketball game, any good player you talk to, he's going to be nervous in the first 10 seconds of a game. And then once that ball is thrown up, you fade into black. Everything else fades. And now it's about just playing and you connect with the person in front of you.
That's beautiful. That's nice. So the Finals MVP, that series where you won Finals MVP, I mean, it just went your way. How did that go? I mean, why didn't Bird get it? Why didn't somebody else get it? You were just out there grinding. You were putting in.
Yeah, pretty much grinding. Right. You know, I had some exceptional games.
Yeah.
The deciding game, essentially the deciding game was the fifth game that we played in Boston. And it was 2-2 against Houston. We thought we were better than them anyway, but they somehow, you know, squeaked two games out. So it was 2-2, and we felt like whoever's going to win, we put pressure on ourselves for game five. Well, game five, I had 28-15. And that was what propelled me to be the Finals MVP.
Undeniable.
So, you know, those things, you know, and I It's so comical because I think about the guys who were on the floor. There were, I want to say, at least five guys who were going to be Hall of Famers. You had three guys who were, let me see, four of those guys turned out to be the top 50 players of all time.
No way.
Kevin McHale, Larry Bird, Robert Parrish, Moses Malone. Were all on the floor at that time.
Man,
and awesome. A little boy from Kinston, lived on the east side of Kinston, you know, became the Finals MVP.
And then Kinston came out with that grind.
Yeah, that was on the grind.
Yeah. And then afterwards, analyst commentary, all that stuff. You're hilarious, first of all. You're funny.
Thank you. And I like when people say that, but also I always do it like Stuart Scott says. I said that to Stuart Scott one time when he was the famous Stuart Scott who worked for ESPN. We were talking, and he was in the building for a game. I said, "Man, I said you are so funny." He said, "But did I give you pertinent information?"
For sure, yeah.
And I looked at him when he said that, like, and he made me think about it. And that's what I try to do. I try to be funny, but at the same time, give pertinent information, which is going to keep you. And I try to do a game like I'm on the sideline, and we're just talking noise about a guy out there playing, and I'm telling you a move that he might do or something like that. So I try to sprinkle in a little bit of comedy along with the knowledge I give in the game.
Totally pertinent, yeah. But no, the funny stuff is just more memorable, you know, and doesn't mean that you ain't being pertinent. That whole line, somebody give me some Cheetos. I saw that shit on YouTube. I watched it like 3 times. Anyways, and you're still doing that, right? You're still.
Yeah, this is my 25th year being a broadcaster.
Damn.
So yeah, I've seen them come. I've seen them go. I saw Paul Pierce when he first stepped into the building, and saw Rondo his first game and all these guys who've come in and, you know, guys like Kevin Garnett to win championships and to be with Larry Bird and see his first game and Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish's first game in the building. And, you know, the Hall of Famers that I played with, Dennis Johnson, and like I said, Nate Archibald. So I played with the greats. I've seen the greats. I broadcast, you know, with the greats. So it's been around Red Auerbach, you know, knowing who he was, one of the greatest architects of basketball. And people talk about the Celtics, and which people didn't know was, one, the Celtics had the first black player, Chuck Cooper, who played in the NBA. Red Auerbach drafted him. They had the first starting black five in the NBA.
What was the first black guy's name, player?
His name, Chuck Cooper.
Chuck Cooper, okay.
Chuck Cooper was the first one. That may be, you know. And then they had the first black coach in Bill Russell. So the Celtics have been forerunners,
right,
in social injustices or the environment that has been around for the longest time.
I gotta ask you, if I continue shooting this documentary, would you let me come film you doing some day-to-day life stuff?
Yeah.
A little interview and a little obviously the pandemic makes everything difficult.
Yeah, pandemic it would have been perfect for you to do. You could have followed me around. Like, you know, I had a great story. Like you think about who you are as a player. Sometimes you might think you're forgotten. Well, there was something that made me that brought me back to the public's eye again was ESPN 30 for 30.
Oh yeah.
Celtics Lakers. And I'm hated by the Laker fans right now, but the 30 for 30 went on and I was a big part of it, and talking noise to James Worthy and having an amazing game 7 here to Boston to win the series. It was so funny how the whole thing about the 30 for 30 was being filmed, and there were a bunch of players who saw it. So we had Jason Tatum in his first year. So Jason Tatum comes out on the floor and starts yelling. He sees me. He's going to surprise. He said, cornbread. I said, dude, what's wrong with you? He said, man, I saw you on that 30 for 30. Damn, you are a bad motherfucker. So you know, you even today, you know, with things, people kind of know you, but they don't know you. And then when they play and the pandemic has made it in a way has even made some of it even, you know, brings you back to life. Because I was in the supermarket. It was earlier, about 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. A guy comes up to me after the NBA had canceled the season, and all these games were being broadcast.
Right.
The guy in the supermarket who was back in the meat department said, man, you played a great game the other day. I said, dude, that was 35 years ago. That's 30 years ago. You're telling about a game that I played. That's 30 years ago. So the pandemic has kind of brought some things around in full circle, especially when they've had to have these games shown again. The Lakers-Celtics game, one of the greatest, I think that game, the Lakers-Celtics 1984, was a forerunner for all these mega games now. Mm-hmm. Because it brought the country almost to its knees as these two great franchises met for a championship. And you think about the guys who were on the floor.
Crazy.
You had Magic. You had Kareem. You had James Worthy. Hall of Famers. Three guys who were Hall of Famers. Then there were other guys who were just good players. Who were the Kurt Rambises of the world. And, you know, all these other players who might have, you know, it was another guy who played. Byron Scott was a rookie that year and played. Wow. And then you look at the Celtics and they had Dennis Johnson. There were like about 8 Hall of Famers who were on the floor for that particular game. So that game was, I guess I want to say, that was the forerunner for all these great mega games that we look at now.
When are you going back to Kinston next time?
Probably in about a month. But maybe next week. Yeah, driving down from Boston. My daughter had a child, and She's in Kinston. No, she's in Charlotte, but my parents still live in Kinston.
That's where, so yeah, okay.
Down there. I'll be back down in Kinston probably in the next, within the next couple of weeks, and I'll be playing spades at Holloway.
Can I come film you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you can be there for Thanksgiving, I guess, then.
I'm going to be there for Thanksgiving. Got to be there for Thanksgiving.
And you know what? You got the documentary premieres Thanksgiving night.
PBS. Wow.
They gave us Thanksgiving night. They put us on the cover of their magazine.
Now, what magazine is this? The Kinston's magazine?
No, it's like some PBS, UNC TV state magazine. Cool. I didn't know anything about it until now. But it's called Centerpiece, and
Like
100,000 homes.
Yeah.
But look, I got to say something. This doc, it's been kind of painful, to be honest with you. It's been great. The result has been nice, and the reward is nice as far as getting it out there and being able to talk to you and being able to get the word out and get some love. But making it was not as easy as I wanted it to be, and I bring it up because it started out strong. I was trying to figure out the angles. The first problem was the archival footage. How do we go about that? Because that's a licensing. We don't have money for that, to license that. How do we get some? So what do? We do something fresh and current. We started doing that. All of a sudden, out here in Hollywood, we went to Kinston, shot a sizzle, about a week's worth of footage, put together a 3-minute sizzle, brought it back here to L.A. And I had some friends in the doc. I don't usually do documentaries. I do like little other movies. And my doc people were like, this is really good. Can we take it to here and here? I said, yeah. And very quickly, we had companies that were in love with this project in Kinston, and for the obvious reasons. And there was a company that produced the Kobe Bryant doc. They produced the Tom Brady doc. They did the LeBron Shut Up and Dribble doc. They were like, what do you want? We want to help you out. I said, okay. You know, here we go. We finally made it. And they said, look, I think we all agreed that I wanted it to be a feature film at first, but then we started talking, this could be a series. This could be like a Netflix series, all kind of, you know, wherever we wanted it. They said, we would help you with whatever you need, as long as you can get access to the school and let them give you permission to film, hopefully, the players throughout the season. And so I went back to Kinston and shot some more and talked to the school, and they ultimately said no. And for me,
they said no.
They said no. So I ain't trying to call nobody out, but that was very frustrating for about a year. We had to figure out what we were going to do after that. Like, as far as
they wouldn't let you see women, they wouldn't let you do what? And go to Kinston High School and take footage of the players?
My specific proposal was, to get access to the season so we could film throughout the next season with Dontre Styles, a new kid, and all the players and the coaches. And I was going to contrast that with Dory Hines over at Parrott Academy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just two coaches, two programs, mainly Kinston High, obviously, is the key ingredient. And I told them everything I just told you in more detail. And they're like, we can't do it. We can't do it. And one of the reasons was, this is so crazy being able to talk to Cedric Maxwell about this right now. One of the key reasons was that they gave me is because of the crime stuff that was in the sizzle. They didn't like the crime stats and the lack of, you know. And it confused me for about a year. I was very pissed off, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And then also they were worried about NCAA violations, which there wouldn't have been any. And other people feeling left out. But my point is, like, it's like ECU. Here you go. Here's East Carolina University. No, we don't want that.
Yeah.
No, we don't want that. Why would we want that?
Yeah.
I'm like, what are you talking about? This is a – I'm not –
that's how you should approach it. And if you needed my help and going there and talking to somebody, maybe we should sit down and talk to the mayor about it. Because maybe he would have enough influence where, you know, we could talk to him about it and get an opportunity, because to me, you there has to be a spark about what Kinston is. And is Kinston perfect? No. Kinston's like any other town. But Kinston has some problems right now about poverty, about people getting killed. That's just the way it is. You can't paint a big picture of it. You can't tell what it isn't Kansas. It is what it is.
You got to have the conversation. It's okay to have a, but you got to start the conversation. You can't not talk about something when there's a
problem. Well, it was the way to escape. Escaping, essentially, that's the word I use, escaping Kinston. You know, because the way you left Kinston, the way Jerry Stackhouse left Kinston, the way I left Kinston was like, I'm not going to be here 30 years from now hanging on the corner. I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be doing something else with my life.
Well, I think I get what they were saying, the high school, but I still don't understand why this was 2 years before The Last Dance, and all of Hollywood knew Last Dance was coming before everybody else did. This would have fell in line right with that. And so I'm just sharing it because for that to kind of fall through the fingers, slip through the fingers like that, and then to see like the PG County doc come out with the Kevin Durant DC doc, called something like, pretty sure they stole my title, to be honest with you, Something in the Water. It was hard. But to get it out into a short and to get it on UNC TV and to always try to continue expanding onto it, it's better than nothing, you know?
Well, it really is. I mean, I, what I always remember was you talked about that, and one of the things you had in your thing was Roy Williams said that he would rather go, if there's a player that is from Kinston or New York, he said he'd rather go to Kinston. He said, I'm getting the best player.
I think he's only an hour and a half away.
and to me, it was really cool because Roy Williams, I want to say maybe it was about 4 or 5 years ago. It's when he was Paul Pierce's coach, and I saw Roy in Charlotte at a game. And I went over to meet him and say hi to him. He said, introduce him. He's like, man, I already know you. He's like, what? He said, yeah, I know you. Mm. He said, Cornbread. I said, yeah. He said, look, let me tell you why I know you so well, and you probably don't know this story. He said, there was, when you were in high school, you were the last great, and this was in Sports Illustrated, I was the last great unknown player, because it wasn't that the, you know, what's the stuff the kids play in the
video games? Or playing?
What are they playing now all the time? AC? No, basketball. How you go all over the country.
Oh, AAU.
AAU. There wasn't no AAU. There wasn't none of that. And he said, but because of that, nobody didn't know who I was. So when I went to UNC Charlotte, I played against a guy who was who went to Chapel Hill. His name was Jeff Crumpton. Jeff Crumpton was a 7-footer, one of the biggest guys in North Carolina. Here I was, 6'7" and a half, playing against a guy who was 6'8". Probably around about 280, and went and played against him in the All-Star game. And, played well while I was, the MVP in the All-Star game. And they end up telling Dean Smith called up Guthridge, who was his assistant coach, and said, hey, God, how did Jeff play in the All-Star game? He said, Jeff, he was okay. He did okay. He said, but that Guthridge talking to Dean Smith said, but you know what? There was a kid from Kinston that tore his ass. And then it went on to that Roy Williams said, from then on, Dean Smith said, we had a rule, and we called it the Cornbread Run, where we were going to see every player in North Carolina physically. And we were not going to let another Cornbread slip and go to UNC Charlotte without us knowing about it.
Damn. That's what Roy told you?
Yeah, Roy Williams.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Cornbread Run.
Cornbread.
Yeah.
So what do you what's going on now besides the pandemic of it all? Everybody's chilling. But what do you besides being an analyst, what you got going on?
That's basically about it, man. You know, you're an analyst and – you know, I'm going to be 60, let's see, November 21st, I will be 65 years old. So, you know, it's not, you know, just staying in shape and mentally staying alert and, you know, physically just trying to work out and keeping a little shape and trying to, you know, make sure I don't eat as much of the stuff that we used to eat in Kinston where, you know, where the pig was the king at the time.
My body's still trying to figure out what's going on.
Don't be turning your lip up now because I know you ate a King's barbecue.
man, it was bad news. Half a day
later. I know you had hush puppies, and they said the sweetest tea is from Kinston. And when he say, when you think this tea is too sweet, put another bag of sugar in it. That's Kinston tea.
Man, I had diabetes when I drank that tea this past time. Well,
that's what my buddy said. I had a friend who went there, and we drank the tea, and she went, oh, my God, what did they put a bag of sugar in?
I grew up on it, but then I haven't had it in so long, and I went back. I said, no, I can't do it.
I had a friend of mine who went to Kinston with me, and we got some tea. And I told my mom, I said, give her a glass of water to go along with the tea. She's like, I don't need that. I can just drink the tea. She took a sip and she's like, oh my God, you put a cup of water and maybe like, you got to dilute it because it is it's like drinking pure sugar. So there are things about Kinston which are just unbelievable.
The big girls love that. Chicks love the last shot opportunity. Somebody give me a napkin so I can wipe my mouth.